I hope you can get your minds back in gear on what we're talking about in Daniel chapter 7. We're talking about the only real problem with that is difficult, really difficult part to interpret is the 10 horns and the one little horn that comes up and has the eyes of a man and speaks great boastful things. And I taught you that your view of eschatology, which will determine how you interpret various parts of Scripture, is determined by your view of the kingdom. You see, let me just get this. I'm going to do some review and summary for you. Remember what I put on the board? I don't have to put on the board again, do I? It's just three basic approaches. The historical or preterist view of Revelation, for example, the progressive view, historical progressive, and the futurist view. Now, people who Bible students, scholars, and speculators tend to view different biblical teaching sections of the Bible in the same way, one of those three ways. And one of the fundamental questions is this, perhaps the fundamental question, is the church the Messianic kingdom? Remember our parenthetical study on that. If the church is not the parenthetical kingdom, now this touches so much of eschatology, so much of Daniel. If the church is not the eschatological, if the Jews were right, that the kingdom was to be a Jewish world empire, and therefore the church not being a Jewish world empire is not the Messianic kingdom, then you are driven to the futurist view of the fourth beast, for example. Why? Because if the church is set up in the day, and also the image, or the image in the feet and the toes, in Daniel chapter 2, if the church is set up in the days of the Roman Empire, and if the kingdom is set up in the days of the Roman Empire, and there's no question that it is, but the church is not the kingdom, then the Roman Empire prophesied cannot be the historic Roman Empire. Except it cannot be, because the historic Roman Empire fell. If the church is the kingdom, then you can keep the toes on the image and the horns on the beast, and you don't have to have this huge gap that we're going to talk about. That is one of the primary hermeneutical flaws in premillennialism and dispensational premillennialism, which is the extreme form. Is the church the kingdom? Were the Jews right or were they wrong? Now, okay, we come now to the judgment scene of Daniel 7. Verse 8 says, I was contemplating the horns, while I was contemplating the horns, another horn, the little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled up out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth uttering great boasts. Now, so God is going to judge this little horn, this blasphemous horn. I kept looking until thrones were set up, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. Its wheels were a burning fire. Say a word, I'll come back to that. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Must have been quite a vision, quite a scene. It scared the liver out of me. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads. What's a myriad? What's a myriad? No? Myriads, 10,000. A thousand on thousands, and 10,000s upon 10,000s, we could say. Myriads upon myriads. We're standing before him. That's quite a gallery. The court set, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words, as the little horn, which the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain, that is the fourth empire, and its body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beast, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. That's okay. Now, so what we have seen is that the, out of the sea, which represents human history, out of the general mankind, arises four successive empires, four successive beasts, as they're symbolically presented. This fourth one is different. It's not compared to any earthly animal, like a leopard or a bear or a lion. It has iron teeth, and animals don't have iron teeth, and it crushes and destroys. Not only that, but out of this confederation of kingdoms arises this blasphemy, boastful, sets itself against God, and God says, we're gonna put this beast, put this horn, put this this phenomena, this boastful empire, we're gonna put it on trial. So look how I've got this outline in our syllabus. Thrones are brought into the courtroom. It's interesting, he's standing there. God convenes a court. The Ancient of Days, God, takes his seat. And what an appearance in this vision. What a word, what a name for God, the Ancient of Days. Think about that. And the throne is set up. And Ezekiel, I got this Ezekiel is misspelled in the syllabus, I think, to the IEL and living corrections. The wheeled throne. And I refer to Ezekiel 10. You know, in the book Chariot of the Gods, what's the author's name, I think? Von Däniken, thank you. Von Däniken says that in Ezekiel 10, the wheel within the wheel, this great scene that Ezekiel said, that was a spaceship, it was a flying saucer, which is, of course, complete nonsense. The ancient thrones were wheeled. They had wheels on them, you know, and what he saw was a glorified throne, not a flying saucer. The wheels within the wheel, the concentric circles, then the wheels, the ornate wheels. And you can just look at the inscriptions, the bas-reliefs on ancient temples. They show thrones having wheels. All the ancient thrones had wheels. Why? Well, because they moved them around. They were very heavy. They were often overlaid with gold. They were very ornate, very large, and wherever the king went in his kingdom, his throne went with him, because when it came time to hold court or to deliver a decree, when he made a public appearance, he would sit on his throne. The throne would probably be drawn by a team of oxen in some cases. These wheeled thrones. Understand, because they were not kept confined to a throne room. Movable thrones. Now, so not all of them were. Some of them have, you know, permanent throne, but the throne would be wheeled. And so, look what he says. The wheels of it were a burning fire. And this is God's throne. they roll in the throne, and God sits on it in this vision. The books were opened. What books? Let's say, books of judgment. I refer to Revelation 20, refers to in that vision as well. The books were opened, and the dead were judged out of the things written in the book. And another book was opened, which is the book of life. Those not found in the book of life were cast into the lake of fire. Now, does God keep literal books? Well, used to, now they use computers. But no, God does not need recording angels to go over the books and see. Seventh-day Adventists say that Jesus is now in the sanctuary. And he's going over the books. And they're risen. It's supposed to take him a year or two, but it's been 30 or 40 years now. Slow reader, I guess. But you understand, this is symbolic. He's seeing a vision. He's not seeing the thing itself. God never forgets anything. Why? Because everything that happens is still in the present with God. Everything that's ever happened is still happening with God. He's the timeless God. He does not need a book. This is for man's benefit. But he's seeing it. You understand? He's seeing a vision, a symbolic representation of the thing, not the thing itself. And the fourth beast is judged, verse 11, destroyed and consigned to the fire. That means that God judges this aspect, this boastful, blasphemous, arrogant aspect of the fourth kingdom, the fourth empire. Now, the other beast, and here, this is the difficult verse, verse 12, and I know parenthetically in my statement here that the strict chronology is not observed here. The other beasts are also judged, but not so drastically or so dramatically. Other beasts judged, not so drastically or dramatically. Why? Note this. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away. That is, these animals, which he saw before, they take their turn. But an extension of life was granted them for an appointed period of time. That is, they do not receive, this appears to be in contrast to the strict judgment of the fourth beast and the little horn. Now, what else that means, I don't know. An extension of life was granted them for an appointed, that is, this may be simply, we may be tempted to make this too complicated, maybe simply saying, these beasts are going to have their time, and they're going to be, even though they're going to fulfill their purpose in God's plan, then moved off the stage of human history, yet they're going to be allowed to exist for the appointed time. I'm not sure what else it means. It's a difficult verse. And I think it's not really important to the general point of the vision. It's sort of an apparent parenthesis, an aside, a footnote. Yes?
I've never heard that used as an argument for conditional mortality. Not such strict
a
judgment because we didn't
quite know. No, I'm familiar with the argument for conditional mortality, of course, but I've never heard this verse. May it is,
did you?
But yeah, I can see why you think that. I don't know that it ever has been. Okay, so what have we seen? Let's bring ourselves up to date. There have been four empires, the four beasts, the fourth being the worst. Very, very vicious. Not only is it vicious and cruel and strong, but it is guilty of a particular kind of attack on God, particular blasphemy, so that God does to this fourth one what he did not do to the other three. He has a court. He finds the horn guilty and destroys it, condemns it to the fire. Now we have the Messianic kingdom prophesied, verses 13 through 15. And I kept looking, as this is what came next in the night visions. And behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man, in contrast to the Ancient of Days. Of course, as you know, this was one of the messianic titles, Son of Man. The Son of Man came to seek and save that which is lost. This is where it comes from. One like the Son of Man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days. No, he didn't come to earth. He came where? Up to the Ancient of Days in this vision. And was presented before him. And to him, that is to the Son of Man, was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom. The Messianic kingdom, that all peoples, nations, men and of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, in contrast to the four empires, which are going to be destroyed. Now, so, here you have in the two things happening in this part of the vision. The little horn, the boastful horn, is judged, destroyed, and the Messianic kingdom, in contrast, is established, and it goes on forever. Now, is this the second coming? Well, many would say yes, I think not. Note this, where does he come? Up to the Ancient of Days and receives the kingdom. Is this the ascension? Well, that may be particularizing it a little much. However, I think that it is at least, if the coming up to the Ancient of Days is not the ascension in particular, what we have is the general teaching of Jesus. Remember Jesus said in the parable of a man who went to a far country and received a kingdom? Talking about himself, about he's about to go away. That is, where does Jesus rule from? on from a throne in Jerusalem or from a throne in heaven? That's the question. Turn to Matthew 24, I think it's verse 30. I've got a little mark here. This is the first edition of the syllabus. I teach this class so seldom that I don't have an opportunity to revise the syllabus. Another bunch of them. Correct. Acts 24, 30. Let me read verses 29 through 30. Now, Jesus is talking about the fall of Jerusalem and what's going to happen. Verse 29. But immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. This is not the second coming. In eschatology, we study this. This is the Olivet Discourse. This is the standard Old Testament formula for the judgmental destruction of a city or a nation. In this case, the destruction of Jerusalem. And then the sign of the Son of Man. Note this, not the Son of Man, but what? The sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, then all the tribes of the earth will mourn. They will see, and look at this phrase, the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. Mine has capital letters. Does your version? Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with capital letters. Does yours have something like that? Why is that? Yes, this is the way my Bible, my New International, indicates that he's quoting or paraphrasing the Old Testament. Well, what is he quoting or paraphrasing? Daniel 7:13. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn in repentance. I think. Look what it says in Daniel 7. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. So really, that should be in capital letters too, in a way. He's referring to this prophecy. Jesus is directly the Son of the Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. But again, where did he come? To earth? No, he goes up to the Father. Coming on the cloud, the Son of Man coming on the cloud, goes up to the Father and receives the kingdom. Didn't come to earth and receive it. And he will send forth, that is from the throne, he will send forth his angels, his gospel preachers, with a great trumpet. And they will gather together his elect from the four winds from one end of the sky. Yeah, he's talking about the reign of Christ, the ascension and reign of Christ, and the preaching of the gospel, not the second coming. Is there any indication in the text that? Look down to verse 34. Truly I say to you what? This generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Another indication, he's not talking about the second coming in those verses. Because, as a matter of fact, that generation is gone. Now, and I mentioned this in another course, in the whole class on the Holy Spirit. If you want an interesting study sometimes, see how Jesus used the phrase, this generation, this crooked generation. One thing you will see very clearly, get the concordance and look it up, you'll see very clearly he was not talking about the generation that's alive in the second heaven. It simply isn't.
I have a couple of things just to be sure. In that being what it is, this starting with 29 and following, it's subtitled the days of tribulation.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. And then down here, now where it says just this generation, it's got a reference. And it takes it down and says, or race. This race will not pass away.
Yeah.
Which I guess is what they're doing to try to support tribulation.
Yeah.
Tribulatory.
Try to get it out of the first century. But you see the general approach? You don't want it historical. It's got to be futurist. Why? Because the church is not the kingdom. Going to move it up. But again, if you want to see the same word, generation, genes, and this kind, and then there is cognates, just take your concordance and look it up. Well, if you're interested, for instance, I've got some notes here somewhere in my Bible. Yes, this 11:16, I'm going to write this down in Matthew, 11:16, 12:39 through 41, 12:45, 17:17, and 23:36. 20 and 24, 29 through 30, which we read. Acts 2:40. What did Peter say? Save yourselves from this crooked generation. The Jews. That's just sort of a shortcut for you. Yeah. For instance, turn back to Matthew 23:36. This is where Jesus is weeping over the city, pronouncing its doom. Matthew 23, I'll give you that on the... I'll start here with verse 20. Verse 29. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and adorn the monuments of the righteous and say, well, if we'd been living the days of our fathers, we would not have been partners with them in shedding the blood of the prophets. Consequently, you bear witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up then the measure of the guilt of your fathers. Where am I? Yes. You serpents, you brood of vipers, how shall you escape the sentence of hell? Therefore, behold, I am sending you prophets and wise men and scribes. You'll kill and crucify them. That upon this city, verse 35, shall fall at the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, from the first murder to the most recent, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar. Truly I say to you, all these things shall come upon what? This generation. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem. Well, my point is that this line that Jesus cites this, and he's not talking about the second coming. He's talking about the ascension, and then here's the fundamental question. If the church is not the kingdom, then the kingdom will not be established until Jesus returns to rule from Jerusalem, where the Jews wanted their Messiah to do. If the church is the kingdom, he rules now from the throne of David, the right hand of God. Which does the Bible teach? Well, I'm pointing out that the scriptures teach, as I understand them, that two things happened in the days of the Fourth Empire. Well, three things happened. This little horn emerges, uttering blasphemous boasts. It is judged. And the third thing is that the Messianic Kingdom is established. How is it established? One like the Son of Man comes up to the Ancient of Days and receives a kingdom. Now, again, we're back to the same old thing. Here are representative views compared. I diagram them for you. Really, the last one is inconsequential. You can mark it out if you want to. I just put that in for the sake of... Not very many hold that. The first view, which is the view that I take, is that the beast is historical Rome. You see where I am in the syllabus? That the ten horns are contemporary historical kingdoms making up the confederation. The little horn is a historical persecutor or persecutors. You can add an S in parentheses after persecute if you want to. The judgment was the destruction of historical Rome. Does the Bible teach that God judged pagan Rome because it set itself against the church? Certainly does. That's what the book of Revelation is all about. And the kingdom is the victory of the church over Roman paganism. That is that God, Rome set itself up to destroy the church. Jesus can't be Lord, says Rome, because Caesar is Lord. And God judged the Roman Empire and destroyed it. And God set up his kingdom. By the way, let me give you some circumstantial evidence that that's a good interpretation. Rome is gone and we are not. We're still here. We're still very much alive. The church is doing business. And historic pagan Rome is gone. If you want to visit, I'll just point out that if you want to see the modern church, you know, this nice new building, it's very comfortable and modern, full of people. If you want to see pagan Rome, go to the Colosseum. Tumble down building and it's empty. Except for tourists. But that's a great thing. If you understand the history, ancient history, and the drama of the first centuries, it's a very significant thing to point out that we're here, they ain't. Because mighty Rome, listen to me, mighty Rome, Rome which had conquered Gaul, France, and Britain, and Spain, and North Africa, and Egypt, and Anatolia or Turkey, and Greece, and Palestine. Mighty Rome, which had imposed its will upon a whole world for centuries. Mighty Rome said, you see these bunch of Christians, these obnoxious, superstitious people, haters of the human race, we're going to get rid of them, and it won't take us long. Because it's either them or us. If we let that pestilence grow, it'll threaten the empire, because they're saying that Caesar is the Lord. We're going to get rid of them. The early church thought they were going to. And they did get rid of a lot of them. But what happened? God says, I think we'll call court in session. We're going to prosecute this fellow. And God judges Rome. And Rome is destroyed. And the church is still here. You see, mighty Rome said it was going to do it. The church thought it. That's why the book of Revelation was written, by the way, to encourage the church. Let them know, look, fellas, read. It's like a mystery novel. You can look at the back and see who wins. See who did it. This is what the book of Revelation is about. Look, there's going to be a great struggle. Many are going to die. It's going to last a long time. But Rome's going to lose, and we're going to win. Well, this is the same issue here. Second view, you understand that? That's glorious. That's tremendous. You've got to be a historian to really appreciate that. You know, because if you had lived in AD 60, let's say AD, when Rome very forthrightly said, okay, the days of the church are numbered. Church is proscribed. We're getting rid of it. You wouldn't have put any money on the church. Why? Because Rome had done that kind of thing before. You'd have like the Super Bowl. You'd have taken the church at 500 points or something like that. Anyway, you'd have given real odds that Rome would have done it. But they didn't do it. I would point out that Paul stood on trial before Nero for his life. Nero put Paul to death, and now men name their sons Paul and their dogs Nero. Well, historical Rome, by the second view, is the beast. We'd agree with that. The ten horns were the successive, that's that progressive view I've diagrammed for you. The little horn is an eschatological persecutor. He's not here yet. The judgment is the second coming. And the kingdom is the millennial reign of Christ. So those are the two basic competing views. But you see, it depends on what the text says. That's why I spent time pointing out that the Son of Man comes up to the Ancient of Days, and Jesus cites that. The third view, which is not held by as many people, is historical Rome, successive, same as the other one, eschatological. You understand what eschatological means? And that means in our future. That's there's no logic to that, but that's how it's used. An eschatological persecutor means he's not here yet. And destruction is the second coming. But then, this view says that the church is the kingdom, and therefore the new heavens and new earth will be established. I've got some friends who hold this view. You understand, they affirm that the church is the kingdom, but simply say, now, what do you have to have? Now note that, well, let me say this to you, that for both the second and the third views, you have to have a revived Roman Empire. Can you see that? See why? That is, the empire is judged, you have to have the Roman Empire there to be judged in the future. I think Dr. Smith at one time, if he still does not, lean toward that third view. I haven't talked to him for a long time about it, but I'm not sure that at least he was sympathetic to it at one time, that I didn't revive Roman Empire. We used to kid each other about it. I would ridicule him for his belief in the revived Roman Empire, and he would ridicule me for all kinds of other stuff. But tease me about it. But I'm not sure about that. He might not. But that view does not deny that the church is the kingdom. It affirms the church is the kingdom. It just said that the judgment and the trouble comes in the future. Now I'm not saying he teaches that. It's into my memory that one time he gave serious consideration to it anyway. Every once in a while he has trouble with the prophets and he has to come and straighten them out. You can tell him I said that. I also tell just Professor Bundy psychology. And one thing you find at this school is that we're not a cookie cutter. You know, your faculty, you get various different views on a lot of things. It's healthy. It's good. Not on matters of salvation. This doesn't wouldn't affect salvation. It's not an essential. I think it's good to get very, and we do disagree on a lot of things. We agree on the basic important things. I think it's good. If he does disagree, because he can't be right about everything. The fourth view is the beast is historical Rome. The ten horns are a revived Roman Empire. I said the second and third view require a revived Roman Empire. I meant to say an extended Roman Empire. That is, the empire, Roman Empire in some sense, has to be in existence. I misspoke that. You understand? The second
what would
third.
Say was, what would they say would be that now, for instance?
Well, some say with the revived the common market or some European confederation growing out of the common market.
Not the papacy.
No. Seriously, Alexander Campbell held that the little horn was the papacy. That there was spiritual Rome. Now this was a view, by the way, it was popular in the Reformation. You understand the Reformation took every chance, the Reformation fathers for centuries took every opportunity to take pot shots at the papacy. So if they could find the papacy anywhere, they'd find it. And for a while there was a view that the little horn growing out of the beast was spiritual Rome growing out of historical Rome. And the little horn was the papacy. Alexander Campbell held that view. Now, that is not a significant view anymore. That's why I didn't put it in here. I suppose I could have. If you want to see, in the Campbell-Purcell debate, Campbell argued that in the Campbell-Purcell debate in Cincinnati. Okay. The fourth view is the revived Roman Empire. There is the eschatological persecutor. The second coming, the millennium. This is dispensationalism. So really, I said that views one and two were the most prominent. That's not true. As far as those who hold them, let me just tell you. View number one, which is the amillennial view, basically, that is the majority view among scholars and has been the majority view in history. I don't know if it's a majority view today or not, counting heads. Because of television mainly. Understand? Number one, but this doesn't prove it one way or the other. I'm just telling you who held them. Number one is the majority of scholars hold that view. Scholarly view. And is historically that's been the dominant view. Number three is the second most popular views. It's the TV version. It's very popular today. It's taught at Dallas Theological Seminary. It is the second. Number two is third in prominence. Well, Barnes holds number two. View number four, which is second in prominence, is held by most TV evangelists. Dallas Theological Seminary. This is premillennialism.
You said view number three was second.
Yes, and I was wrong. I'm correcting that.
Okay.
Number four is the second one?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What's number three?
The second one. One is one, two is three, and four is two.
What is three?
So what's three?
Three is fourth, I guess. It's not held by it. Barnes, for instance, historical progressive view holds number three. So it would be. I really shouldn't say that. Let me just teach you because it's hard to tabulate that. All I'm simply saying is that the two important competing views. Let me just say it this way: the two important competing views today are number one and number four.
Number four is the TV dispensation.
Yes. Yes.
Number four sounds an awful lot like what Armstrong preached before he thought he died.
Yeah. It's dispensation. It's a different form of dispensation.
This was a little more awful lot.
Yeah. Well, the basic difference was who is Israel?
Yeah.
Where the premillennialists say that the Jews were Israel, he said that we are the Anglo-Saxon of Israel. That's the other difference is that is the basic difference.
Two people are historically
new. No.
Premillennial.
Okay. Two is premillennial. I'm sorry. Four, which is number two. I should number these. Okay, number one is amillennial, which is the correct view. Number four is dispensational premillennial.
Number
four, okay. Number two and three, a lot of variety in those scholars. All I'm simply saying is that it doesn't say that right or wrong, but numbers one and four are the major views today. It's been made so mainly because of television and Dallas Theological Center has been popularized. It's become the official view of the Assemblies of God and most independent Baptist churches. It's taught by some of our churches. We got a parachurch organization in our churches by Donald Reagan. It's called the Lion and Lamb Ministries, which is standard dispensational way.
The contemporary historical kingdoms and
extended Roman Empire? The answer to the contemporary was that these were 10 kingdoms in the historic Rome, which are now all gone. The progressive is that that Rome has perpetuated itself in successive empires or kingdoms or states up to today. The Roman Empire has never really died.
And the revived died and
it's coming back. The revived is it died out but it's coming back.
In what form?
Common monarch. Most of them say that. Or something like that. You see what happens? The view is this. If the church was the kingdom, you got no problem. Rome, historic Rome, can be all the Rome. But if the church is not the kingdom, then what you got to do is you got to get off and see what happened was Jesus went back to the Father and Rome fell. So what they've got to do with the revived Roman Empire, what you got to do is get all the props back on the stage. So when Jesus comes back, all the prophetic elements will be there. That is, you've got to have the nation of Israel restored, you've got to have the temple rebuilt, you've got to have Rome, get all these first century props back on the stage. Then when Jesus comes back, he'll do what he was supposed to first time, but the Jews wouldn't let him. Well, I think when Jesus came, I think he did exactly what he chose to do. I don't think he needed the Jews' permission to do anything. They'll say, well, anyway, and the church is the parenthetical mystery. We study that in eschatology. This is overlap. Okay. Any questions? Y'all see the basic options here? The last one, I think, is such a minor view, you can just mark it out if you want to simplify it. In my next syllabus, I won't even put it in. Now, the end, to finish out, we're not going to finish today, we're going to fall behind. Verses 15 through 18, we have the interpretation of the vision in summary. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. And I approached one of those, that's very human, isn't it? It alarmed me. I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. But note this is very ambiguous. He just tells them the nature of it. Doesn't name the kingdoms. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will rise from the earth. But the saints of the Most High will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, for all ages to come. That's very simple, isn't it? First of all, these are four kings or kingdoms, and the saints and the Most High will receive the Messianic kingdom. Okay. But Daniel, I love this. Daniel says, no, that's not enough. Tell me more. That's a little vague. Then I desired to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful, with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, and which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And the meaning of the 10 horns that were on its head, and the other horn which came up, the four which three of them fell, namely the horn which had eyes in the mouth, uttering great boasts, and which was larger in appearance than its associates. I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. Now there's an element that you did not state earlier. What did the horn do? It waged war with the saints. The whole. Which saints? Did Rome wage war with the saints? Certainly did. Overpowering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the highest one, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. Thus he said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms. And it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it, Rome. As for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise. Another will arise after them. He will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings. And he will speak out. Now, what that gets very particular. Let me, let's go ahead and finish. And he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one. This is where I get that he was speaking blasphemy. In the original, the first statement just says boastful. But he makes it very clear that it's blasphemous kind of boasting. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one. The long battle. How long? So he will wear down the saints. How long was the church persecuted? From when to when?
Until Constantine. 200
years. Well, from Roman persecution, from AD 65 roughly to 325. A long time. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the highest one. He will intend to make alterations in times and in law. They will be given to his hands for time, times, and half a time. The court will sit in judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. And the sovereignty and dominion, the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven, will be given to the people of the saints, the highest one, that is the church, the universal church. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, that is, all over the world, Christ will be preached and honored. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me. My face grew pale, and I kept the matter to myself. Now, which I would never have done. Now, what about this fourth? What about this times, time, and half a time? Well, come back next week, and we'll see. I said these were contemporary kings. Kingdoms, which meant the Confederacy of the Roman Empire. Now, whether it was 10 exactly, or 10 divisions, that doesn't mean they were exactly 10. It means it's a small, indefinite number. Have a good weekend, you all. Be sure and go to church somewhere. And send money to all Robert so he doesn't die. Is this his last week?
No, he's got another month.
Another month? I'll say one thing. He said the one thing that would guarantee I didn't send him any money.
Isn't that all?
Think about it. Wouldn't it be a real shame if you take him to the party?
I do not.